We'll never find that one, and I'll be blamed. Nothing ever goes missing that they don't look at me, ever since that time I lost my horse. As if that could be helped. He was white, and it was snowing. What did they expect? Hello and welcome to Two Champs and a Chump, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast founded in 2010 by Will Lentz, myself, Brett Zeiler, and Greg Atkinson. Major props go out to FFG for putting out a great game, George R. R. Martin for an amazing product, Card Game DB for our hosting, and Josh Woodward to the Creative Commons licensed music you hear today. Welcome to Season 3. Hello, guys, and welcome back to the 108th installment of Two Champs and a Chump. This week, due to some scheduling difficulties, I don't have any of my regular guest hosts on, but we do have a special treat for you guys. I have a couple interviews with a couple of players that won some regionals on the very first weekend of regional season. Mr. Ben Terpstra up in Nebraska, and the always lovable, or something like that, Mr. John Bruno over at Kingdom Con. There were a couple other regionals over the weekend, so I don't want to slight those guys. I don't want to slight the other winners as we go forward into regional season, but it's going to be difficult to get all of you on the show. But I will try and have a few folks on and kind of get a sampling of things as we go throughout the season. Also, we have had a little bit of interesting news from FFG recently. We had some teasers and information spoiled about the next cycle of chapter packs, the King's Road cycle. I think we're going to take a little more time to talk about those spoilers and implications and whatnot once I have my regular co-hosts back. But I wanted to acknowledge that. We have had a little bit of We also have had a little bit of listener feedback lately that I'd like to acknowledge. Mr. Michael Conus has written in, had some good luck with the Black Sails Greyjoy toolbox deck that I posted Card Game DB a couple weeks back. So that seems pretty awesome. And he was also asking for a little bit of deck building advice and how to settle on something that is actually tier one. I think that's also something that we're going to tackle with my regular co-hosts. But he also requested at the end there, he says, I have a challenge for you. Put together a top tier deck or as close as you can get to one out of Baratheon. Just a thought. And this, of course, was sent sometime before Bruno's win over the weekend, which turned out to be a Baratheon deck. Your guess is as good as mine, whether it's top tier or it just happens to be the pilot this time around. But give Bruno's interview a listen and check out some thoughts here on Baratheon and his deck. So, without further ado, here we go. All right. Welcome, guys, to the first interview of our two-part interview series this week. We've got Ben Terpstra on the show. I did pronounce your last name, right?
Yes. Yeah, you did get that one.
Okay, good. Who won the recent regional up in Nebraska. And it's the first time we've had him on the show, so I thought we'd run through, give him the chance to tell us a little bit about himself before we delve into the meaty tournament goodness. So, Ben, how'd you get into Game of Thrones, and how long have you been playing?
Well, I've been playing basically ever since it went to LCG, just shortly after the core set and the first – well, not the first one. It would be the Raven cycle came out.
Okay.
So what's that been, like 2.5, 3 years?
Yeah, like I think 3-ish. That sounds about right.
Yeah, so just kind of randomly fell into it. Jared Clue from Iowa City kind of got me into it. He's like, hey, play this game. You know, it's LCG model. It's, you don't have to buy tons of cards. I'm like, ooh, that sounds fun. And started playing it and just fell in love with the game. Hadn't read the books or anything, so just got drawn in that way.
Oh, wow. So have you gotten around to reading the books at all now?
Oh yeah, totally. I didn't get too far into the game without reading the books.
Well, good. unlike certain other people who may appear on the show somewhat regularly. Daryl. So, you know, I have a really terrible memory for this out of the past. So, in those 3 years, have you been doing pretty well at tournaments before? Is this the first regional win for you? My memory's a little fuzzy.
Well, this would be my first regional win. The highlight of my playing career would probably have been at Gen Con last year, where I placed third.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah, I lost to Rams Greyjoy deck just before the finals. And it was pretty similar to the regional deck I played this past week.
I was thinking that this had been something you'd kind of been working on for quite a while now.
Yeah, for at least a year and a half or so, I've been kind of tooling around with this one a bit.
Okay, gotcha. And you brought it down to the Moon Boy also, right?
No, actually, Moon Boy, I was playing something different. I just kind of wanted to explore some other options because I've been playing this one so long. And then realized this one was much better and just went back to this for the regional.
You're right. Now that I'm thinking about it, I remembered that you'd had Knights of the Hollow Hill when we played. But, yeah, now that you forced me to slow down and think about it, you were playing Baratheon with Knights of the Hollow Hill, weren't you?
Yep, exactly.
Gotcha. Well, you know, tell us a little bit about how the weekend went for you then. I mean, obviously well, but did anything stand out about the games as you played during the day?
Well, there were a couple that really stood out. I think it was my second or third round, I can't remember which. I was playing against Justin Fox from your guys' area.
Mm-hmm.
He was doing a Stark Siege deck. And first turn, he had out, like, a Northern Cavalry flank, like, a Hungry Mob and a Dire Wolf and a Card in Shadows, which everybody knows is most likely Sirio. Pre-plot, he drops down a couple of Epic Battles. I'm like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? And then I realize, oh, he has no Intrigue icons. So I flip out Shadows and Spiders.
Okay.
Which is the plot that a player cannot declare military power until he or she has won an intrigue challenge.
Gotcha. Yeah, that was actually something I was going to ask a little bit about whenever we got to the deck list, but now's as good a time as any. Was that really pretty much just there for Siege matchups?
Not necessarily just Siege, but kind of Stark in general, a little bit of Bera and Greyjoy in there too. It's essentially just a way to slow down my opponent until I can get my lock on. And it worked beautifully in this case. He had, like, one card in his deck that could have caused me a problem, and luckily he didn't draw it and play it.
what would that one card have been?
Because he did was it Fear of Winter?
Okay.
So we're just like, okay, I played a card, you played a card. Next round.
Well done, sir.
Yeah, that was the highlight of that game. And then when we cut to the top four, both those two games were just grueling as all get out. I had to start against Jesse Shingen from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And what was Comp he board for anybody looking for board names.
That's right, board names. Let's see, he was playing a Stark Maester deck. He only had four chains on his agenda, but I realized pretty quick that first turn that the only way I was going to beat him was if I could just kill all his Maesters.
Mm-hmm.
So he ended up at the gates for Lewin first turn, and in Marshalling phase I went ahead and killed him. It's like I'm not letting him get any chains off easily. and I was just able to keep all his maesters out. There was one turn he got all his challenges off and had a maester out, so he got three chains off. And at that point, I just had to stall and stall and stall until I got rid of all the maesters, essentially. Rainus's Hill was the big card in that matchup because that allowed me to just kind of stop him a couple turns and keep it going. I think he got up to like 25 or 30 power at some point.
Wow.
Yeah. But
did he, and he never got all the chains off of his house card?
Just had that one left.
Wow.
You know, I burned through Lewin, hit three of his maester of the Last Hearth, and hit two of the, what were the little guys? The one cost one.
Oh, right. The Old Town Scholar, I think, right?
Yeah. So I knew there was at least one of those left. I didn't think he had anything else left in the deck. And then I pinged in a little intrigue challenge. He had about five or six cards in his hands. I pulled the one, and it was that last maester. And he's like, okay, that's it. I got no more.
Oh, wow. That sucks for Jesse. You know, normally I hear about, or have had happen to me, that sort of thing, you know, when you've got like 8, 9, 10 chains on an agenda. At 4, you normally feel pretty safe about being able to get all those off of there.
Yeah. And I think it was the matchup really affected that, because I had just so much targeted kill that I could just pinpoint those maesters. And it essentially just let everything else go through, because I didn't care how much power he got, how many characters he killed, how many cards he got. As long as I could kill those maesters, I was fine.
Gotcha.
The only reason that worked, though, too, was because this was top 4, there was no time limit, so I didn't have to worry about that at all.
Right. Though, granted, if there had been a timeout or a time limit, it sounds like he would have timed out and you would have had the win anyway, right? Because he still had the chain.
Well, I mean, we would have drew then, because you can't win, but he wouldn't have lost because he was.
But it was top 4 single elimination. Can you draw there? I guess I haven't needed to run into that.
I don't know how that would exactly work, because I guess he couldn't win. So yeah, I would have had to advance at the single elimination at that point.
Yeah, because that almost happened to me at the Moon Boy against Zach Bunn. Also, me playing Maesters and him with Targ burned though. Thankfully, we didn't quite have to actually figure that out.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was the final 4, you said?
Yeah, that would have been the semifinal match.
Okay, how'd the finals match go?
The final one was almost as good. You know, you're thinking, how can I top that? I was playing Jesse Mariona for the final.
Props to you, of course, for winning, but props to Jesse for making it to the finals. I think he's been itching to do that sort of thing for a while here.
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting deck. It was a Stark Brotherhood deck.
Okay.
So using the agenda and all that, and he gets, you know, Barrack out right away, and I think he had the Mad Huntsman, not first turn necessarily, but pretty close. And he's just ripping me a new one. And I'm like, oh, crud. I'm just going to lose this thing. This is so anticlimactic. Because this was like second turn. And he's got like 13 power on Barrack. He's got a Flaming Sword on Barrack. So my burn doesn't do anything.
How'd you stall that out?
Well, funny little thing. I have my Maraxxus out. Win Dominance. Draw my card. Take a look at it. I just drew Nightmares. So next turn, I did also have a Myrinese Brothel out, so a little attachment control there. So I just flopped, what would it be? Threat from the North. Forever Burning somebody, got rid of the Flaming Sword, and then just dropped down to Dragon Knight and bye-bye Barrack. Well, after playing the Nightmares, of course.
Gotcha. Still, that's well played. Several pieces had to go into that to get him taken out.
Yeah, and I needed that Nightmares right at that time, because he kind of went, like I said, you know, he's at 13 power, and that thing was over.
Yeah, oh, and I'm I'm sure that was frustrating for Jesse. Man, I hope he's not listening to me laugh at him in this episode.
But it was still a battle there from then on. It's not like he couldn't win. Because then he got a Mad Huntsman with another Flaming Sword, and then he put a Frozen Solid on my brothel, so I couldn't get rid of anything. Luckily, I had another brothel, but I was able to get rid of that, and then the Flaming Sword with the second brothel, and burn that guy down, because he got up to, you know, another 9 or 10 power, so it still wasn't finished once I got the barrack, even.
So, I'm a little curious then, sorry, I don't want to jump on it unless if you had some other interesting thoughts from the field or interesting things you saw over the course of the tournament before I jump into your deck. So I just want to give the chance there if you had anything else.
Those were the main highlights. One game I was worried about coming to the tournament was Shane Sedenka from Iowa City came down, and I've been playing with him a few times. He had a Lannister House of Dreams deck with Tunnels of the Red Keep, which just causes me problems, all that strength pump.
Mm-hmm.
I got him in, I don't remember which one it was, second or third, opposite of Fox, whenever it was. And I kind of lucked out. He wasn't getting many shadows, and he wasn't getting many characters either, so what characters he did play, I could focus everything on that guy and get him down. And then just by the end, he was running out of shadows, so it was just even strength at that point. So I kind of was able to grind that one out, luckily. But that's a pretty good deck. He was kind of hit hard by the restrictions because he was running a number of refugees, which is great.
Oh, sure.
Pump them up.
Mm-hmm.
Like nothing else. So.
Okay. Well, how about we dive into the deck here?
Okay.
Now, we already brought up one thing that I was going to mention with Shadows and Spiders, so maybe I'm going to go backwards here a little bit and just look at the broader picture about how you came to this deck. You know, what do you really do you feel this is? Well, sorry. Let me try that again. Do you feel this is a deck then that has been evolving for quite some time based on, you know, other things you've seen? You've been working on it for quite a while, obviously, and, you know, Bruno's deck was real big here in the fall. Has it just been a very gradual evolution over that time, taking, you know, bits and pieces of stuff? Or was there something in particular that you felt would set kind of your style of Knights of the Hollow Hill apart? Since, you know, looking at the deck list here, it seems to have a fairly different theme than, say, the House of Pain or, like, Zach Bunn's Shadows Burn.
Yeah, it's pretty much straight burn without too much beyond that. What really kind of set me on this deck was back when Dragon Knight was released.
Okay.
Because for some reason, with that card, it just seemed to open up the burn. It just, because before that, you really had to find a way to hit those three strength characters. Because those are all your big guys, all the ones that you really want to get rid of are in that three strength sweet spot. You know, you had your Flame Kiss and Forever Burning. But then you run up against people who can't get hit by events or can't take attachments, and it just kind of, you couldn't quite get enough. And for some reason, the Dragon Knight just really kind of kicked that off. You could bump that up to hitting four strength characters with that and the Flame Kissed. It would hit both, you know, if you're immune to events, I can still hit you. If you can't take attachments, I can still hit you. And it just really kind of blew open that deck build for me. Initially, it started out kind of as a combo burn Dothraki deck, and then I just dropped the Dothraki entirely and went straight burn, and it just kind of took off from there.
Yeah, looking at the list, it is very burn dedicated. Looking at that here, and of course, there's a few other kind of non-standard burn cards in here that I find fairly interesting. The first one was going to be Shadows and Spiders, But after that, what about your choice of restricted card here? Because I see Search and Detain sitting in the plot list. What pushed you to that?
Well, nothing in particular. I had it in there before it was restricted. At that point, I wasn't playing any restricted card. So just kind of as the restricted list evolved, it's like, oh, okay, so this is restricted. That's fine. I have my one. And then just recently, Hatchling's Feast got put on. I originally had that in there. And just felt that since I had almost no good location control, that I wanted to keep Search and Detain in just to kind of give me a little bit of a delaying tactic again over the Hatchling's Feast. Because there were enough times that Hatchling's Feast wouldn't really work for me because either there wouldn't be enough characters in play, I didn't want to use 4 influence to pay for a 3 influence cost, because that's one thing, I don't have any 1 influence locations, it's all in 2s.
Okay.
I guess except for the right keep, but I didn't want to wait around for that to hitch the Hatchling's Feast. So I just kind of went that way to go in with Search and Detain, and I think I would probably keep that. This is really the first tournament I played since that restriction and kept the Hatchling's Feast out of the deck.
So what wound up getting swapped in for the Hatchling's Feast then?
Westeros Bleeds came in for that.
Okay.
Just another sweeping reset. It kind of serves a similar purpose to Hatchling's Feast.
Yeah, yeah, I was kind of thinking, though it has the downside there of hitting your own guys. Did you find yourself in situations where you were a little worried about it because it would wipe your own board too? Or was that never really an issue?
Not a concern ever. Basically, I come into the game thinking every single character I play is worthless to me once I play it. There are so many just come into play effects. That's what I'm playing them for. Like, you know, the Dragon Knight, once he's come in, he's done. King's Landing Assassin, Dragon Thief, Red Warlock, all those, they just come into play and, well, they've done their thing. So I don't care. They can get killed for claim, Valor. You know, a lot of them are low strength, so they'll even get hit by my own threat from the north. So everybody in here is expendable.
Okay. Well, let's see. Man, I'm pulling myself in different directions here with questions I want to ask, but while I'm thinking of characters then, I am curious, looking here at your character base, about a couple of those. The first one that jumps out at me, since you're talking about the low strength, is that Magi Crone. And, you know, a lot of folks have been back and forth on her as far as whether she's decent draw or she's just too inefficient and too expensive for what she does. Is she something that's kind of paid off for you in the long haul? Is she a fairly new addition to the deck or something that you'd be thinking about dropping? Just,
yeah,
what are you feeling?
Yeah, she's been in quite some time in this deck. Just with the amount of burn I have, she just will draw me so many cards. I mean, she is an ally, so she is a top target for Dissensions or Varys, but she can just be so efficient with what I have. If I have one Forever Burning, I can easily get at least 2 cards off for a turn if I don't need it for something else. Because end of challenge phase, oh, yeah, I'll just burn my own Crone.
Right.
Card. Dominance phase, get it back, play it again. Oh, that's 2 cards I just got off of her, so that's good. And even, you know, with my threat from the north, I do have to play around it a little bit, but I put her out, at least 3 or 4 characters are going to go away to that, and she's one of them, but I can still trigger her 3 times for that. Mm-hmm. So that's just 3 more cards right off the bat. You know, I would pay 3 gold to draw 3 cards in a plot phase.
Whoa, yeah. You can do a lot of cool stuff with that.
So she just is super efficient, at least in this build, because I have so much burn that people are hitting 0 strength regularly throughout the game.
Okay. Well, the next character I'm looking at here is another one that people, I think, have been kind of back and forth on. And I know I personally have. That's the Sorrowful Man.
Ah, yes.
And he, you know, he came out and he had to get the errata and whatnot. And, you know, I thought he sounded really cool at first. And then we realized he didn't quite work the right way. He got errated, so he did work the way we thought he did. And I don't play Targ all that often, but after his errata, I played a Targ deck for a while because I was excited about that. And bizarrely enough, for me at least, he never really paid off like I was hoping for, and I wound up, you know, scrapping that deck and moving on. Has he been paying off as much as you'd like? Or?
He's a rock star in this deck. You know, I don't get to trigger him every game, but when he does, it's worth more than his weight in gold. Talking back to my game with Fox, there was another round that was kind of key in that game that the Sorrowful Man really played into. I had him in Shadows. He had, I think it was Storm of Swords, so he was getting two military challenges off of that. And played a couple more epic battles. That I chose that for my Threat from the North turn, which was good. Because he had a Rickard Karstark out, doesn't kneel for military, still had the Serio in Shadows, and then plays out a Cavalry Flank. Well, he used up all his gold for that, so I was able to pop the Sorrowful Man out, kill that, and then burn the other two guys. So he had no characters left. Just being able to hit those big giant armies that are just hard to burn is just a godsend, because, you know, a lot of them have no attachment, so I can't hit them with my good, with the Flint Kissed, and they're, you know, 5-6 strength. I'm it's going to take everything I have to burn them down, and I just need one Sorrowful Man and they're gone. Plus, I also have a little bit of a dearth of power icons in the deck, and just being able to pop one out just to snag a couple power here and there is really nice, too.
Oh, yeah, and that deadly is not insignificant when you have a dearth of a particular icon.
Yep, exactly, because that just helps push things through that much easier.
Nice. So did you find yourself doing much with Krasnys, Mode, Naklos, with... I mean, were there still Maester decks floating around that you were looking at hitting with him, or what was up with there?
Well, that was interesting because, yeah, he was originally into Combat Maesters. I don't want you using those attachments. We need to get rid of those. But once the heavy restrictions hit the Maesters, I kind of went back to him. Do I really want to keep him in? Because I'm not seeing those. But then I realized, you know, with Tin Link being on the restricted list, a lot of attachments are probably going to start coming back. I've been seeing, you know, what's that Lannister one? Enslaved?
Uh-huh.
You see, you know, what's it called? The Frozen Solids all the time, too.
I hate that card.
But, you know, Krasnys, hey, I'm just going to flip that back on you. You know, it's great being able to use your opponent's cards against them. So I felt comfortable leaving that one copy in still, just for that myriad of other attachments that I could possibly do something with.
What else in that deck looked particularly intriguing to me? I know that I did have at least one more thing. Oh, yes. The Condemned by the Council there. You'd mentioned being kind of light on location removal, and I recall Bruno commenting that was one of the big problems with his House of Pain deck, which was even lighter on location control than this. Was the Condemned a fairly recent addition? Do you feel like you're at a reasonable amount now after you know, going along? Or would you still want to try to find more room?
Well, yeah, it was relatively recent. I had been toying around with Litany of Fire originally, because being able to burn locations seemed like a good thing.
Yeah, and the flavor there is just cool, right?
Oh, exactly. I'd love if there were more cards that could do that a little bit better. You know, again, it hits that they're all three strength, so there's that difficulty of hitting that spot. I really found it was only effective if I could play it on my Threat from the North turn, because otherwise I can't get a kill effect on them, or a terminal effect, essentially. Mm-hmm. but when I play my threat from north, I really want to get their characters so I don't have any burn left for it. Sometimes if I'd have enough influence or the gold left over, I could use Forever Burning to just mop everything up. But it was just too inconsistent, and I rarely had enough burn left over to use it. I toyed with Pyromancer's Apprentice, and it just didn't quite work like I wanted it to. Because at one point I was trying to do a lot more shadow stuff and try and fit the Dragon Pit in here, but kind of scrapped that for this. And that really left me with Condemned by the Council. I have a decent amount of intrigue icons on my characters. I think almost all of them. Let me check here really quick.
Not the Sorrowful Man that we were just discussing. Not the Sorrowful
Man, but beyond him, Dragon Knight, and the Carrion Birds, I think everybody has an intrigue icon. And I got a couple. You know, Varus and Jora with stealth on that. That combined with the burn, I felt like I could get some of those intrigues pushed through if I really needed to. If there was a location that was causing a problem, I should push that through by just focusing the burn on that particular icon that round. And it's been decent enough. I think I'll probably leave it in just to give me some amount of location control. But that really is still the biggest weakness of this deck, is just the lack of that.
Gotcha. Let's see. Last one, you know, last thought I had here is about a location. And I have seen and heard about you playing it extensively. I've heard rumors of it other places, but I haven't seen it personally from many other people, and that's going to be Rainus's Hill. How awesome is Rainus's Hill? How important is Rainus's Hill? Does your entire deck revolve around it?
It doesn't necessarily revolve around it, but it complements it extremely well. I use it every game. It's useful because, again, I got the target to kill is what I do. And that means I'm putting your best characters in the dead pile. And if I can take those back and throw them back in your face, it's just a beautiful thing. You know, if nothing else, I can just stall the game a bit longer to get my draw going, get that control lockdown. It's just an amazing thing. One story from the regional season last year. I was playing Jesse Shingen again. He was doing his Dothraki deck at that point, and I was able to hit it. I had a two-claim plot out. I think it was Retaliation back when it was unrestricted. And he had all three of the named Dothraki in his dead pile, along with a Pike Phalanx. So I got also a Bloodcrate Screamer. So that was a three-claim military challenge, three-claim tree challenge, three-claim power challenge, another three-claim military challenge. And on both of those military challenges, I took a power from his house and took a card from his hand. So that was the best I'd seen that work. It was just amazing. I was able to hit every single one of those in that phase. But no, that location is just bonkers. And the fact that I discard it so I can just play it again, is amazing also. Cause that helped keep me in the game against Jesse again this year. Cause I had two consecutive turns with Rainus's Hill out, and then I drew a third one the next turn and had it just sitting there waiting for the right moment.
To put his own Beric back into play on your side.
Well, against Shingen.
Okay.
See, so, you know, to put his two cavalry flanks that I'd killed and, Karstark and all that right back in his face.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that card is brutal when you've got all the kill to back it up. But awesome. Is there anything, any sweet thoughts on the deck that I didn't happen to coax out of you?
I'm trying to look through. I mean, they're the basics, tarts of, like, Meraxes is just an amazing card. It's probably one of the best cards, just hands down in the deck, just because it's so efficient and so good. You know, just the boost for dominance when I don't have characters to keep them from getting that much more on me is great. And the Lady Annie's Chambers is also probably one of the MVPs of the deck. I only run four attachments, but Free Flame Kiss and the Black Raven. Just getting those over and over and over and over and over and over again is just huge in getting that lockdown going.
Yeah, you don't see many people running triplicates of two different unique locations like that. But evidently worked well for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's what I need. I need to see them as soon as possible. And then if they get discarded, I can still play them again. So it really doesn't hurt me at all to have the three. Worst case scenario, I have a duplicate for them or a dead card in hand. But at that point, I'm drawn enough that it doesn't seem to matter too much.
Gotcha. Okay, well, there's still a whole lot of regionals left in the season. So for folks listening here, we're still early in the season, but what advice would you give them gunning for some of these later regionals?
The biggest key is just know your deck. These hard decks especially, they have so many moving parts. The biggest benefit I have from using this one is that I played it for a year and a half. So I know I could almost play this deck in my sleep, even how complicated it is. I have to admit, you know, we were with rings, so of course we're going to go out partying and try not to the joust, but, you know, it's rings. How can you say no?
I don't think he'll take no for an answer.
Exactly, exactly. So I was a little dead running off of, like, 2 or 3 hours of sleep in the joust, and the first round I was just kind of dead to the world and kind of went on autopilot and was able to pull out the win still. But just being familiar with what your deck does and knowing what you're trying to do is just a huge benefit going into a tournament.
Well, awesome, Ben. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to give you one last opportunity to throw something out there. Since I won't have my regular co-hosts on the show, give us a prop or a slop.
Oh, prop or slop. Oh, I didn't know I was going to be able to do this bit.
Yeah, I know. I shouldn't have put you on the spot there without warning.
Coming fresh off it, I got to give props to Rings. It was just a fantastic tournament. And he is just a wonderful host. You know, just free booze flowing. Set us up with a cube draft after the joust, even.
Nice.
It was just a great time all around.
Well, glad to hear it, man. I'll second that props to Rings, even though I didn't make it for that weekend. All right. Thanks for being on, Ben. Look forward to hearing from you again and hopefully running into each other at another one of these regionals.
Definitely. Sounds good.
Cool. All right. Here we are with the second half of our interview episode. This time around, we have reigning world champ and now reigning Kingdom Con champ, John Bruno, with us on the show to tell us a little bit about a deck that I think surprised just about everyone when he won with it for a couple different reasons. One of them being the house, Baratheon, the other being the agenda, the long voyage. So I think we should definitely have quite a bit to talk about there. So before you actually played this deck, John, what did you think about the long voyage?
Well, when I was part of the group that evaluated the cards or rated the cards beforehand on CardGameDB, I actually said in my comments that I gave it a 3, but that's because I hadn't had a chance to really play with it yet. And I thought it had the potential to be a 4 or a 5, especially in a Baratheon rush build. So it's kind of nice that it actually worked out the way I said, that I got to play a Baratheon rush build that used an 85-card deck, which seems like counterintuitive, but it actually worked.
So were you thinking of this deck ahead of time when you wrote that review, or is this a total fluke?
It was really kind of a total fluke. I mean, I wasn't thinking about that deck at all. I thought about a couple types of decks I might want to play with it. I thought, you know, obviously a Stark deck using Widow's Watch sounds pretty cool. Martell deck with all the reveal getting cards in their hand sounds pretty cool. The Baratheon one was only because I think Baratheon's great when they get the extra draw. And being able to not have to play the Knight's Agenda and not be able to play Summer, I can save both of those and be guaranteed the one card every turn that I get with the Long Voyage versus maybe I do, maybe I don't get the card with those other two agendas.
Gotcha. So the other surprising thing is that it's House Baratheon.
Yeah.
What were you thinking about House Baratheon before playing this deck?
Well, I really didn't go into the tournament planning to win and putting any kind of, like, what I thought would be a tier one type of deck into the field. I had talked to people before, and including yourself after Worlds, Tiny Grimes on his podcast about doing something different for the first regional. I won Kingdom Con last year with a Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill deck, so I wanted to play something that was kind of different. And I decided I want to play something fun, and I did say I played Baratheon, so I went into it, and I wanted to try the Long Voyage, so I put it together. And I actually put it together, you know, really about less than 24 hours before the tournament began. So it was just, I took 200 cards, laid them all out, pulled out 85, and that's the deck I went with.
So before you did that, would you have agreed with, I think, most everybody at the time that Baratheon was the bottom house?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I definitely feel out of the 6 houses, I would rank them 6th. And a lot of people still probably might. Some people might rank them underneath neutral. I don't know, but.
Would you still rank them down there after having played it?
Well, this is the thing I think people have misconceptions about, is house, when they should be looking at deck. You know, the rankings aren't really by house, they're by deck. Like, just because you're playing, say people think right now Stark might be the best house. Well, there's a Stark build or two that are really, really strong. But if I'm playing like Stark Tullys, that might be a fun deck to trigger off River Run and stuff. It's not really a type one build. You know, it's a fun deck. It's maybe a tier two deck or something. But you should be looking more at the deck type, not the house type. And I don't think people really rank as much by the deck type. So I would say that a version like this of the Baratheon build with not necessarily Long Voyage, but maybe just kind of like the deck type way I kind of built it, it's a stronger deck than I think people think.
Very cool. Well, let's see then. You know, I think we could probably stand to take a little time to look at some of the card choices that you've got going on here. And I'm trying to decide. I should have thought about this a little harder before we got rolling for the episode. But where should we start here? Well, since we're talking about houses and deck types and stuff, I am a little bit curious what you feel like the power Baratheon cards are that you knew for sure when you sat down to build this. Hey, these are the Baratheon cards that I feel there's something here that I got to work with.
Stannis, that gets the Stalwart and Renown and Stealth and all that cool stuff, is probably Baratheon's best overall card, I think. He's even better than Shadows Bob and Knight of Flowers Bob.
Really?
I mean, Knight of Flowers Shadows, I do.
So why are you thinking that about Stannis? Let alone why are you hating that Knight of Flowers?
Well, I don't hate that Knight of Flowers. It's a great Knight of Flowers, but I think the metagame's changed a little bit. I'm seeing lots more of Shadows cards being played. You have, I mean, for the one turn you play King's Law and get rid of some stuff in Shadows, doesn't necessarily stop you from getting rid of everything in Shadows. I mean, I can easily, you know, find ways to still put cards into Shadows even after the challenge phase begins, whether it's Mirror Read if you have that, Sirio. You could bring him out of the marshalling, put him back in again at the, you know, in the shadows phase, in the challenge phase. You know, there are cards that you can do, you know, some fun, tricky things with. And I see a lot more people playing, city plots. So City of Lies might be a plot that people are playing a lot of, but also you got a House of Dreams deck with, Tunnels of Red Keep is pretty popular. And Lannister has really gone up in popularity, and they've got some great Shadows cards like Tyrion, the Guildhall, Qyburn. A lot of people play Varys and Sirio. And Stark Siege decks are a little bit on the uprise, so you're going to see Sirio in there, and Meereen's still popular, even though she's restricted. I don't think that they're as strong as people think they are anymore because of the Shadows cards.
Gotcha. You know, and it's interesting, you mentioned some of that stuff, like Lannister kind of creeping back up and whatnot, since Stannis is immune to location abilities. You know, the hot newish Lannister card, Pentoshi Manor isn't going to touch him.
Exactly.
The stalwart Lannisport Brothel isn't going to touch him.
The Scourge couldn't, if you want to play the Scourge. I mean, Lannisport Tourney Grounds, the Targ Marine Tourney Grounds. There's so many.
I hate Marine Tourney Grounds. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah, okay, so I can buy in on that. Was there anything else in their repertoire that was just really calling out to you?
Well, like I said, I do think the Stannis is the best card. I chose not to use the Shadows Knight of Flowers or Bob because of I chose the Nelson Mary Treasure card. I chose Search and Detain. I still think Melisandre, the one where you win an intrigue or a power challenge unopposed or dominance and claim extra power, is amazing. I went with the Knight of Flowers that has Joust, who I think is a great character.
Yeah, I wanted to ask how well he did for you.
He was amazing. If you think about it, let's take the Knight of Flowers that I know he can defend. Okay, so that's his advantage he got. He can defend. However, if you have Shadows, he's not as good because he can't defend. With the Knight of Flowers that I played, he's got Joust. So they can only defend with one character. If I have Smuggler's Covert or any kind of strength boost for the Knight of Flowers, he's going to win his challenge. And I get two power if he wins alone. That's the same I would have got if I won two challenges with the Knight of Flowers before.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with this one is has the Noble Crest. And if you're playing Lannister and they have you kill the wrong dwarf, they kneel the other one. They can't touch this one.
Yep. That's a good point. Plus, of course, the protection it brings to the table on
Power
of
Blood.
On Power of Blood.
Right. And there were games where somebody had Valor and I had played Power of Blood and I don't lose my Knight of Flowers.
Very cool.
So the other cards I would say were very strong for the deck were, like I said, Melisandre was pretty awesome. Smuggler's Cove was great. The card that came up, which was so much fun to play, I mean, I only had one copy, but it came up a couple of games. It was the Red Queen's Faith was fun. And but probably the card that surprised me, even though it's been around forever, about how good that card is Banner for the Storm. It's so good.
Yeah, you know, I don't ever really see it around anymore for some reason.
You put it on that Knight of Flowers. You put it on Melisandre. You put it on, I mean, there's so many characters you put it on. First off, you get them to stand. They can do a second challenge. Secondly, you know, you get to have characters in defense if you go first. Third, you have them standing for the dominance. And fourth, again, against Lannister, who's playing all this kneeling stuff. It's a way to stand your characters, especially in the dominance phase against the brothel because your guy's not kneeling.
It's pretty cool. I'm thinking maybe I just haven't seen it since it turns into an attachment that, you know, people are scared away from it with the whole 10 link stuff.
Yep.
So, you know, it's a lot more viable now than it was just, a little over a month ago.
Sure.
You did mention in passing there a card that I did kind of want to ask about since I do see a copy of the Red Queen's Faithful hiding out here. I mean, that's the kind of card that, a lot of us kind of freaked out about at first.
Well, that's what everybody does in this game.
Yeah.
House of Dreams, oh my gosh, the game's broken. That card's so bad. I mean, it's a good card, but it's not the game ender, you know?
I mean, it doesn't end the game. I still say it was a poor design choice, but
yeah.
that's a different argument, I think, to make.
Sure.
But the Red Queen's Faithful, you know, it was really popular, I saw, for a while. And then when some restricted list changes hit, I know that kind of threw a wrench in the deck that Zyler had been running down here, and then I didn't really see it after that. Do you think it was, you know, just a case of overhyped? Is it really still quite good, and people have just run too far the other way? Or was this just needing something to fill another slot in your deck?
No, I put it in because I just thought it was a cool card. I mean, I had lots of unique characters in my deck. So I really tried to play a lot of uniques. And, I mean, there were some turns. It was amazing the amount of characters you put out. I could put out one game I put out, you know, one of the knights, like one of the Rainbow Guard knights, Mario Seaworth, and Robert or Stannis, and there's already three uniques right there, and then I can play that character for four. I mean, it, you know, if you think about it that way, with all those uniques, he's pretty cheap, 7 strength, and it was really good actually against the Stark Siege deck. The one game I had that went 4 turns, where my opponent had like, you know, 3 early power, 5 early power, and just being able to win one challenge with him, and you put it on. I'll take those 3 off of your agenda and put them on. I know a character is going to die. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it still seems like a really strong ability. And if rush decks are becoming more popular right now and more viable, as they sure seem to be, that power moving ability potentially becomes even stronger than it had played out before.
Sure. Yes, I agree.
You know, you brought up all those unique characters you've got in the deck, and this is something I thought was kind of interesting looking at it. You, especially with the uniques, have a single copy of a lot of cards here.
Yep.
Especially considering it's, you know, an 85-card deck. Was there any thought that you had that with an 85-card deck, you might have a little more padding to run extra copies of some of these uniques to up your odds of drawing them? Or did you just did the old standby only run one of a unique, you know, because it might die? Was that too strong to override?
No, the ones I really wanted, like if I wanted Robert, you know, the Fat Bob, the Double Renown, if I wanted him, I ran three of him in the deck, and I ran 3 of Stannis. And those are the only 2 characters that I ran 3 of. Some of the other uniques that I ran 2 of were, I ran 2 of Willis Tyrell.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to not see a 3rd of him if Lanny is looking more popular, you know?
And they are. And so, he was great. And I mean, 3 of him would have been kind of cool, but especially since he is an ally and he can discard. So, it wouldn't be terrible to have a 3rd copy of him, and he was really good. But I did have 2 of him. Oh, I forgot another key card in the deck was Eddard Stark. I only had 2 of him. I probably should bump him up to 3, the one that protects nobles. So he was really strong. I only had 2 of him. I only had 2 of Mel, 2 of the Knight of Flowers. But after that, everybody was like, okay, if they come out, they come out. They don't, they don't. Because nobody else is really that important. It's more about bodies than it is who they are.
Gotcha. Not even, you know, like a stander like Maria to go with that Knight of Flowers or anything?
Well, I was playing other... that Knight of Flowers can only trigger once per turn anyway, his ability.
Oh, touche, salesman.
But I do like... Maria had 1. I thought of having 2 of her, but she's got 1 strength. You know, she might be easy to kill. I decided to play only 1 copy because I also had 2 copies of King Robert's Hammer, which is a better card in the environment now since there's not as much summer and winter.
Mm-hmm.
I had other kneeling cards that I had, any other standing cards, sorry, that I could play. The Banner Storm was really good too. So, yeah, it worked out well.
Speaking of standing cards, there's one in here that, honestly, I don't think I've seen since, I don't know, a very long time ago when Fox tried it in a Stark deck against me for a little while. I'm seeing Cannot Be Bribed, Cannot Be Bought.
Love that card.
In this deck. How often were you able to use that during the day?
0.
Was that just because you didn't draw it? Or
there were a couple games where I drew it, And, well, I actually had it in my opening hand, and I mulliganed. I had it, and it was depending on the house I was playing. Like, if I was playing a Lannister player or somebody I suspected, like a Maester deck that's going to have the city plots, that's pretty much why I put Cannot Be Bought, Cannot Be Bribed, or whatever that card is in there. I put that in the deck because it's a great standing card, get you your power. The one time I actually got to play it was against the Lannister player who played You Killed the Wrong Dwarf, not my guy. I felt pretty cool because now I'm going to get two power on my character and get a card, but then they played Paper Shield.
Oh.
They still had King Robert's Hammer, but it sucked anyway. But that was the only time I actually played it the whole entire day, but it was great to have in the deck. I mean, if here's the truth. If I had gone more than the second or third plot against some people, second or third turn, I would have had to play it. I had it in my hand when I was playing somebody with the city plots. We just didn't make it far enough from the place that he was in.
Are you seeing much of lots of, or any really, Parting Blow floating around out your way? It tends to make the rounds quite a bit down here in a variety of houses, which, you know, gives you several extra options to actually play that Cannot Be Bribed, Cannot Be Bought.
That was another card, too, that I considered why I wanted to have the Cannot Be Bought, Cannot Be Bribed card, because I know in my Tard deck I was playing it, in the Martell deck, especially playing Ghastly Grey, it was great.
Oh, yeah.
Greenblood. You know, it was a great card to have in there. So Parting Blow is still played, maybe not as much, but I still see it. And I know I have it in a few of my decks. So it's another good card against that.
Nice. Well, let's see. What else can I segue into here? You know, I've got one. Of course, Cannot Be Bribed, Cannot Be Bought gives you a little bit of draw there. Mm-hmm. And of course, I mean, you're getting that draw every turn from the agenda, which probably won't be for many turns, judging by what you said about the games. But you do have a handful of other draw cards in the deck. And one really stuck out at me here. I really didn't expect to see this, especially not in a deck like this. That's Lucky Bones.
Oh, so much fun.
Tell me more.
All right, Lucky Bones was really cool. Again, it was another draw card. Here are the effects that I figured I can do with it. Because it puts cards in your discard pile, it ends up being like another draw card that way. There was one game in practice that I played the night before. So I played three games of this deck after I built it on Friday evening before I actually played in the tournament. And in one of those games, you use Lucky Bones, and two of the cards that I ended up discarding, well, I won a power challenge. You have to discard two cards first and you get the draw card. The two cards I discarded was a Robert Baratheon and the Loyal Guard, the one that dupes him, or any noble. And now they're sitting in your discard pile. So the next, and I got a draw. The next turn I get to play Melisandre's Scheme. I get the dupe Robert, I can put that noble on him. If I get that Royal Entourage, they're coming into play. There are cards that go in your discard pile, but because you're going to play Melisandre's Scheme, it lets you look at more cards, because there are some in your discard pile, and you're still going to draw next turn. So it got you through more cards. So it was actually a pretty effective draw.
So, yeah, that's actually a pretty good point there as far as, you know, you're going to get to draw the one card, or two if you're super lucky. Did you have Davos in here?
I had two of him. I had two of him also.
Okay, so two. Yeah, two if you're super lucky. But then, yeah, if you know you're going to follow up with Melisandre's Scheme, then the Lucky Bones is effectively a draw three or potentially four card.
Right.
Yeah, that's actually kind of cool right there. It doesn't play very well with setup, though, which is kind of a bummer. Let's see. I mean, kind of glancing at things, you only had 10 events and 4 attachments. So setup probably wasn't too bad for you, at least as far as, you know, those sorts of cards that just strictly can't be played on setup.
Correct.
Did you feel like setups played out okay? That in the larger deck size, it seems like you could have some issues with the, you know, having enough resources to play out early in the game for setup and things like that. Did you have trouble rounding that out?
I thought that would be an issue, but I actually had a couple 5-card flops and
really?
A few 4-cards, yeah. And, you know, there was a game where I could have had a 6-card flop, but I had another limited in my hand. So It didn't come out that way, but I sometimes had three cards. That was actually pretty common, three or four cards. And surprisingly enough, there were times when I kept that and didn't mulligan when I had a three card flop in one game. I remember I flopped a seat of power and two characters. And I think one was Renly, and I don't remember the other two strength. Oh, it was Maria. So I like Renly and Maria and a seat of power. And I kept that because in my hand I had another seat of power. I had a narrow seed that I ended up drawing up to, but I had another seat of power in my hand, and I had characters I could pop out pretty quickly. So even though your initial setup is varied, with Baratheon, you get a chance to make up for that a little bit because seat of powers are so good.
Yes, yes they are. Okay, well, you know, that hits on quite a few interesting things out of the draw deck. The plots, though, you know, have a lot of standard options. But you did mention that your restricted card of choice was Search and Detain.
Yeah.
What pulled you over that direction for?
All right, well, two things. I mean, this is people have talked to me, asked me my opinions on decks like forever. The reason that I tried to build a deck and make a deck effective, just like I did for World, was your plot deck has to have a lot more thought into it. A lot of people try building their deck and then put the plot deck around it. I like to come up with an idea for the plot deck and build a deck around the plot deck. I think your decks win you more games than people realize. I mean, this plot deck, I have that available to me every single turn, where I never know what I'm going to get out of the deck. And if I had the Knight of Flowers or I had Robert in my deck as my restricted card, or even, say, a High Garden Refugee because I wanted to work on setup, which I actually considered at one point, too. I know I'm going to be able to play Search and Detain anytime I want to play it. Whether I win initiative or not, I don't know, but I have access to that card where I don't have access to the other cards.
Yeah, that seems really reasonable with that larger deck size to be able to choose something that you know you'll have that access to.
Yes.
Well, is there anything, any particular tidbits about the play or thought process that I didn't manage to hit on that you wanted to impart to the listeners?
Well, like I said, just what we were saying right now is I do think, you know, you need to put a lot more thought into the plot deck, how you want it to work around your deck. City decks right now are really, really, really popular. Everyone's playing a city deck, but the reason why I hate the city decks is because it locks you into your plots. You don't get the options. You're pretty much playing, if you're going to have that city plot cycle, you're playing at the gates or City of Lies is your first turn, or maybe even your second turn if you're playing both of those. You're playing I'm going to, you know, kneel people with City of Sin. I'm going to kill people with City of Soldiers. I'm going to copy one of those with City of Secrets, no, Spies. And I'm going to play, you know, City Besieged because I want to get rid of a location. Because right now, everyone's got a big boner over City Besieged. Oh, my God, I'm going to get rid of a location.
I do love that plot.
Yeah, I mean, I can blow up House of Dreams location. So that's why everyone's playing that. And, you know, that's five plots you're locked into. Then people are also playing Valor. So that's six plots, and that doesn't give you too many other choices. Where in my deck, the one I played here, I really thought about the ones I wanted to play. And I didn't even have a reset in my deck. I didn't even play Valor or Wildfire. I did have
a rush deck. Who cares about reset?
I know, but I didn't actually intend it to be a rush deck. It just happened to play that way. So that was really the truth. I mean, I really thought I'm just going to throw all these characters in. When they come up, they come up. You know, I'll be able to last with people because I get an extra card every turn. But I didn't expect that to last, you know, two, three turns. I mean, I played, as I, you know, posted in my article, I played eight games in a total of 21 rounds. That was it. And there were two games I played last year at Worlds that were 21 rounds total between just in those two games. So it was crazy.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so you said it kind of turned into a rush deck in play and stuff. And you've also mentioned that you think Stannis is probably Baratheon's strongest card. But for your deck, the way it wound up playing out over the weekend, I'm going to put you on the spot here. What was the single strongest or best or most important card for you? Was it indeed Stannis?
No.
Well,
It was
Pray
not
tell,
Vince.
What replaced Stannis?
Well, I will give my secret away, but the number one card in the deck was the Art of Seduction.
Ah. A plot, I see.
Yes. Like I said, plot decks win you more games than people realize. I let off a lot of the games, not every game, with Art of Seduction. Because I let off with Art of Seduction, I locked my opponent into that same plot two turns in a row. Most of the times, in fact, I don't think there was any game where that plot being up there messed me up by having it being in play a second turn. But what ended up happening a lot of times, again, especially against city decks, they're going with At the Gates, 3-1-1. City of Lies, 3-6-1. But either way, 3 gold. And if it's At the Gates, that's even better. Because what I do, second turn, is I come back with Search and Detain. I bounce something back to their hand, now they're screwed even more. They're not starting off the city cycle. Because the city cycle's not being triggered, I got an extra turn to have my character standing, alive, whatever. A lot of games, they come back third turn, and they have to play Valor, because by the second turn, if the game isn't over by then, I had a lot of power, and then I just play Power of Blood. And they didn't kill anybody. Anybody important.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really good plot. Saw it have quite a bit of popularity last year with these Martell Maester Rush decks. Man, I can't really remember where I first started seeing and hearing about those. Where was that?
Oh, maybe it was me who was telling you about that even before the Martell Maesters were being popular last year.
Oh.
That was an ad. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. We'll go figure.
The truth is that locking them in that first plot really, really, really slows down people's decision making, because you don't have that second one to be able to do what you want to do. And again, knowing the initiative battle is really important, what's going to happen second turn. That second turn always feels free to me when I do it. When I was playing the Martell Maesters last year and I get to use Art of Seduction and I get that free turn to play Two of the Spears, and I don't have to worry about you doing anything to my characters. Like, maybe you're going to kneel them all. That's not going to happen. So even this year, like, I'm playing the Baratheon one, and I'm playing Art of Seduction. That second turn, I can do what I want second turn and not have to worry about what you're going to do plot-wise to mess with me. You're not searching for a card. Here's the best one, my favorite play. You're playing against the Lannister, and they got a Golden Tooth Mindsetter, too. You don't get to draw a card. You know, so it really messes them that way, too, when they think they're going to get it. So they spend gold to put that card out, and by the time they actually get to use it, they're not going to get anything out of it. And so it's pretty – it was fast games, and the four games I won on the second turn, my opponent played one plot.
Jeez. Okay, so here's a thought for you. I may be delving further out into some design and theory sort of issues, but, you know, you'd said that the game – should really kind of revolve around the plots and the construction there. And, you know, that's potentially where things are won or lost, right?
Sure.
So my question now, after thinking here and hearing more to remind me about Art of Seduction, does a plot then that takes that power away from the opponent have a disproportionate effect on the game?
Quite possibly.
Okay.
But again, there is an opportunity for it to bite you in the ass, too. If you block down the wrong plot, you know, you have two turns where you're screwed for two turns.
Yeah, there are a few of those.
Yeah. There was one game that I played, actually, that surprised me. In one of the practice games I played on the Friday night before the tournament, I played against the Lannister player who was playing Lannister Power Behind the Throne. And their first turn plot was Fear of Winter. And my first turn plot was the Art of Seduction. So we were locked into Fear of Winter for two turns in a row, which actually was really cool for me. Even though I lost, because they played Cersei, first turn they put out Cersei, I lost four cards. Didn't matter, because in the March, I still got Stannis and another good character out. So that, I mean, I had flopped one. Stannis was my Marshalling card. So I didn't have to worry if somebody died, they died, because I had a couple other characters out there. But Stannis was there for me. He was able to stand, do his business, stand back up. He was the only king. Second turn, while Search and Detain is out, you know, against the Fear of Winter, Cersei goes back to hand, slows him down even more. Even though they still did two intrigue challenges against me, it didn't matter. I mean, third turn I come back with negotiated the set, put my hand back up, put all those characters back out and play.
That's pretty rad.
Yeah. It was pretty strong.
Well, you know, I asked Ben a question as we kind of wrapped up with talk about his deck and things that I'm afraid we may have already hit on, and that was, you know, these regionals were on the first weekend of the regional season. There's still a whole lot of them coming up here, a lot of players playing and stuff. So I was going to ask what one most important bit of advice or insight you would have for those players headed out there to these regionals, you know, looking to win a crown of their own. I'm tempted to say your answer might be that plot tidbit you already passed along, but just in case you have something else, I'm going to open it up for you.
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked, because I actually have a different answer.
Oh, good.
So it's not the plot. That was the plot tidbit, that's just general play. I mean, that's how I just feel in general about building decks and playing. In terms of regional season, it's a totally different animal. I mean, you hopefully are seeing people playing their top-level decks. There's always going to be, every single week, a deck that's brought to the tournament out of left field. And you're not prepared for that. Because you're looking at everybody, you're looking at the success people are having with this current deck, that current deck. Like right now, Ben won with Knights of the Hollow Hill. I won with Baratheon Long Voyage. Cincinnati won with Martell Long Voyage. So there are going to be people that are going to be like, oh, I'm
Black Sails Greyjoy won in Austin.
Correct. Right. And there are, those people are going to look at those decks, because we have a big group of net deckers out there also. Well, those people are going to look at decks and say, this one, that regional, I'm going to build that deck and play it. Then they go out and play it and get crushed by it. You know, it doesn't do as well as it does for somebody else. Two things about that. Number one, the person who builds a deck knows their deck. They've been playing with it and work with it. Although I didn't really know my deck. But anyway, they built and worked at their deck and know how it works. Also, their meta is totally different than yours. You know, their deck might work against that group of people in that field and that decks that are brought there, where you played at yours and now you have a deck type that wasn't played in somebody else's. You know, so every deck has its strengths and weaknesses, and sometimes our game is, I mean, our game being Thrones, is a lot of rock, paper, scissors. And you bring a rock to a tournament against a lot of paper, you're going to get screwed, where they're bringing their rock against scissors and they're going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice would be, don't just build a deck because people did really well at the tournament. Don't just take somebody's deck and play that deck and expect it to do as well for you. You still need to know what's in your deck. You should build a deck that you feel strong about, that you feel good about, that you know. And usually, you know, you're going to at least have more success or at least feel better because you know you won or lost based on your merits.
Wow. You know, it's almost like you guys spoke to each other. Those are very similar tidbits for listeners.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. Now I might actually have to listen to the podcast. I want to hear what Ben said.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Well, awesome. John, thank you so very much for being on the show. Since my regular co-hosts are not on here, I'm also going to put you on the spot for one very final question.
Okay.
Do you have a proper slop you'd like to throw out there?
Oh, boy, do I. Let's see. I would like to give props to my Southern California brethren. They are all a great group of players to play against, and even though they are ubiquitous net deckers who only copy me and are just my lemmings, apparently, they are.
And they're way behind, too. Man, Tiny was still running House of Pain.
Oh, my gosh. What's up with that? And they are, I mean, they are really, truly some of the best players that I play with. I mean, a lot of people know Ram. He's kind of quieter, never posts, is never on the board. But Ram de Leon is the best competitor I have ever played against in this game. And he beats me just as often as I beat him. And also when we play Thrones too. So he is definitely like the number one guy. But John Krause, you know, James Speck, Ryan Jones, Alex Esposito, Chris Schoenthal, Tiny Grimes, all those guys I play with all the time who make me a better player. Christian Na has really improved a lot. He's a troll, though, but he's really improved a lot. My group that I play with, I feel very fortunate that I do have a large group between Los Angeles and San Diego who I get to play with that makes me a better player. So I am very fortunate for that, and that's a huge prop. You know, again, the big slops will be to, you know, Nate French and Damon Stone and Kevin Tomczyk for, you know, coming up with all these crazy facts and making the game OP for people when they play against me, because obviously they're just doing it for my benefit.
You know, actually, I'm just borderline tempted to say that you are OP, sir. I'm going to petition to have you restricted.
I should be. Well, that's why I had to go away for 3 years. So, you know, I was banned for a little while, and then I came back in a restricted list, and, you know, now I guess I'm back, you know, playing again.
All right, well, fingers crossed.
Wait till my card comes out. When my new card comes out, let's see if you think that should be banned.
Ooh.
I can't talk about that.
Okay, well, fair enough. But it's probably going to need to be banned.
Probably.
I'll
have to go away for a while again.
What's that, sorry?
Then I'll have to go away for a while again.
Yeah. Fair enough.
But really, in all seriousness, I mean, I do have a great community I play with. You know, the only slops I have in general, I mean, that obviously is inside jokes. Some people get that, some people don't, my slops. But the slops will be the people who try to put this game down. Because besides the people I play with, I've been playing this game for 11 years now. And I have many of my true friends, best friends, good friends that I've met through playing this game. We have the best community of players in any game, in anything I've ever been a part of. And there are many people, like I said, that are, even the time when I wasn't playing the game, I still kept in contact with, that I consider, like I said, great friends. And I've met so many even new people in the last 2 years that I've been back playing the game. And it's nice to have positives come out of events. I hate when negatives come out, like some things that came out of Worlds last year, and people who live for making the world negative and tarnishing the game. This is a great game. I mean, FFG, sure, they make mistakes. There's things they could do better. They're trying, and we have a great game. No matter what people will say about Christian Peterson, the game didn't die. It's still here when it could have died a few years ago. So, you know, I would just say be positive about the game. We're lucky we have this game.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me speak and say that, Will, because it's something I've been feeling for a while, and I just really wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to give you a platform to get that out there.
Well, I appreciate it. I don't get a chance to speak out that often. I mean, my name's not that out there. People don't know me as well, so I need these opportunities like this.
And you are very rarely on any of the podcasts.
Exactly.
Needed to really take the opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, I got one last prop. Sorry, before we go away. I forgot to mention Jonathan Benton. Really, Jonathan talked me through. I basically threw ideas at him, and he said, yeah or no. And I didn't do what he said. I did what I wanted to do anyway. But still, it was nice to have somebody like Jonathan to talk with, because – he also is a very underrated player, I think, in the game. I know he's got a championship card that doesn't really count because it's a melee card, but he is, I consider, one of the best players in this game, too. So I appreciate all the help he gave me, too.
You called him an underrated player in the game?
I think he is underrated.
Every year when folks are trying to call, like, who's going to win this year and stuff, I keep naming Benton. Nobody ever listens to me.
I know. Well, once he actually wins a joust event, then, okay, I mean, Worlds, come on. I mean, you know, we have people who have titles and haven't actually won a tournament, you know, so it's like, you know, I like to see them win a real tournament first.
At least he has won a tournament, so.
He has won a tournament, yes.
Good for him. Too bad he had to screw me over to win it.
Well, you know, if it had to be one of you two, I'm glad it was Jonathan.
Yeah, well, I suppose so. Someone had to do the screwing.
Exactly.
Right on. Well, John, thank you again for being on the show and blessing us with your knowledge.
Thanks again, Will, for having me and the Game of Thrones community. Keep playing, because it's a fun game, and keep supporting the game.
All right. Catch you later.
All right. Thanks, Will.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, Danger Zone or something. Turn around, there's nothing to see here.
Run away, no reason to be here. It's the goal.